Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to the Quarantine Break podcast. Thank you for joining me for episode 11. How are you doing? I hope you're keeping safe out there. It's a cracking show today. My guest is stand-up comedian, writer and presenter Dane Baptiste.
And everyone was like, yeah, they can see you, you know, and he went, did I say no? I meant yes. Sorry, I misunderstood the gentleman, I imagine, because of his African extraction. But what I meant to say was, yes, we can feed starving children. So I did that. So yeah.
It's a really interesting conversation, and Dane has a lot to say in this episode. We talk about comedy and life in lockdown, and Dane gives his thoughts on the recent conversations around British comedy, as well as Black Lives Matter and how we can do better. Take a listen, and I'll be back at the end. Hello, Dane. How's it all going?
It's going good, man. I'm taking it a day at a time now. As to say, I'm quite bored of this situation now, so I'm a bit ready to like leave before I become completely institutionalized, because I can already feel myself getting used to the fact that I'm like, I don't like shopping when there's a lot of people now. How I'm going to return to the normalcy of being in central London with tourists who go, the best way to look for something is in the middle of the street. Yeah, I don't know if I can return back to that state, but I'm sure in the same way that I had to adjust to life in lockdown, life outside again will be, just take some time, but I'll be okay.
So today we're recording this in the middle of the week, which for me brings a whole new level of recording stress. At weekends, I'm just hoping that the neighbours' kids don't jump up and down on my ceiling for 8 hours a day. Weekdays, it's all about builder's noise. I mean, I haven't seen my dad in 3 months, but hey, at least I'm sat in a rented London flat watching the neighbours finally get that extension to their already massive house.
Yeah, because we always like to see that, the people that are living a privileged life right in front of us. I'll tell you something, Simon, that's bothered me, is that when I've done the odd drive to the shops and stuff, there's still roadworks.
Yeah.
But they've had so much time to do them. Like, if you were a company, like, when the streets are deserted and there's no one out, that'd be the perfect time to complete any planned engineering works or any roadworks or fix any pipelines, because the amount of traffic has been reduced over the last 3 months. It'd be easy to get everything done. And I know you could be like, well, what about the social distancing? How close do you see construction workers working together? Not very close in the first place. And if government or whichever companies they work for had given them like the masks and gloves to perform their tasks, which they get anyway because they're working in hazardous materials, so they've already got masks to stop them from inhaling harmful things, and they already have gloves to protect them and non-conductive boots. So they already have hazmat-based equipment, and there's still roadworks that are uncompleted, and it doesn't make any sense, especially now where we're in a recession. They want the economy to return to a state where it can be hit the ground running and we can encourage spending and proficiency. Your infrastructure is still incomplete, and I do not understand that.
It would have been the perfect time, wouldn't it?
It would have been the perfect time. Look, all the guys could have gotten with their jobs, and they could have been working and stuff, and then we could have been at home, and then no one would have to interact with anybody else, but nope.
And then we could have at least swapped over. They could be at home right now.
I would have happily, like, if been involved in roadworks for the extra money, to be fair. Look, I think now there'd have been contractors, if they'd been like, anyone want to do some work, like putting down some tarmac in, or like, you know, putting up a roofing, a lot of people would have gone for that. Especially in my line of work, you know, being at the performing arts industry is kind of on ice right now, doesn't really exist. Then yeah, a bit of construction work would have been nice coming my way.
Dane, we start each episode with a big question, the one that everyone wants to know. On your own podcast, you ask questions like, what is a terrorist and what is masculinity? On mine, I simply ask, Dane, how do you take your tea?
Green.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I used to drink a lot of tea when I used to work in an office, and I really feel like it was responsible for, I used to have like two sugars with it, and I was responsible for putting on weight. And so I thought I was getting a bit chubby. Plus, then I learned that I was lactose intolerant, so that doesn't really help as well. So now I mainly drink green tea with honey. I have something called shotgun tea. Is it called shotgun tea? Or firecracker, that's it. I got firecracker green tea, which is like really strong stuff. And this comes in the dried leaf form. It doesn't even come in a tea bag. It's the real stuff. I have that with honey instead of sugar with my tea now. So that's how I have my tea. Or the other way I have my tea, Simon, is bubble with strawberry syrup. Because I have the palate of a 12-year-old. So.
It's a good job you stopped having sugar then, because we'd be talking to a very different Dane right now.
Oh no, yeah, this is post realizing the dangers of fructose Dane, the Dane that's had seven fillings.
Well, now we have your tea order, and if you're listening to us for the first time, this is the podcast that takes a socially distanced tea break from the world. It's a world where footballer Marcus Rashford this week asked the UK Prime Minister if he wouldn't mind feeding starving children for the summer, and the Prime Minister initially said, nah.
Yeah, and everyone was like, yeah, they can see, you know, and he went, did I say no? I meant yes. Sorry, I misunderstood the gentleman, I imagine, because of his African extraction. But what I meant to say was, yes, we can feed starving children. So I did that. So, yeah.
It was quite an incredible story, wasn't it?
It's an amazing story, man. It's, for me, like, when I've ever looked up to an icon, especially even as a child, I've always paid attention to both their prowess in their chosen field as well as their activism, you know, outside of that field. And, you know, you look at people like Paul Robeson and what he did for like miners in Wales and stuff so many years ago. And then, you know, again, with, you know, the charitable and the philanthropy that people like Cristiano Ronaldo do as well. But yeah, I just thought it was crazy to A, think that there would be any kind of consideration to repeal school meals for poor children, especially with the fact that now we live in a country where food banks outnumber fast food establishments in this country. But yeah, I just find it very puzzling. And almost, there's also an air of smugness for me, especially given the current social climate whereby, you know, we've had demonstrations from people who refer to themselves as All Lives Matter, people refer to the organization as White Lives Matter, people that are in the English Defence League, so they defend the rights and, you know, the culture of the English. And it's like, how have all these interest groups that you would think would care about the plight of white working class children, how come they all missed this? And this black dude from a hood in Manchester was able to help legislation pass to feed starving who statistically are going to be predominantly working class white kids. And he managed to do that, and all these guys forgot. And I was like, that's mental, but it's such a good thing, man. It's a lot of the time, you know, people constantly tell people of profile, whether it's in sports or entertainment, to stick to football or stick to comedy and stay out of politics. But, you know, by using his platform, you know, he's made, you know, he's been able to politicize a very important issue, man. And yeah, definitely have nothing but respect and I'm in awe of Marcus Rashford.
The man's incredible. I mean, someone posted on Twitter, I think it was yesterday, and I think there is an element of this, that because we are a terrible people, that the first time Rashford misses a goal or has a poor game, fans will be against him saying stuff like, oh, you should concentrate less on politics, more on football. And it's we try and tear these people down when they've done such incredible things like he has done.
Yeah, it's because a lot of people that go to football are fat, innit? So like, they're just used to having pies and sandwiches, so they don't know what it's like to be hungry. I think they would... Hungry people complain less, Simon.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, because their main complaint is, I'm hungry. So it just, again, shows people's privilege if you're able to complain about stuff like that. But, you know, I just think when you juxtapose the two things, like if I was Marcus Rashford, a bunch of idiots being like, I'm not either, the intrinsic reward of knowing that you're able to make a difference and help people less fortunate, like you were yourself at one point. It just dwarfs anything people can say to you anyway. And, you know, I feel like if me as a Arsenal supporter can be inspired by a Man United player, I think anything's possible and everything else doesn't make any difference.
Exactly. I'm a Liverpool fan and I've been in awe of the man. I do want to get back to the point where we can start to make jokes about Marcus Rashford and say things like, that's the only thing he'll win this season.
Yeah, exactly. And it's going to get to that point as well. And I really feel like, you know, that's not too far off. And really, that's a win that will last longer than a football season anyway. Yeah. So I'm sure he'll be fine. Also, like, you know, the guy's a pretty tall, handsome guy. I'm sure he'll have a lot of work outside of football. Prick. Like, I want to be back to, like, look here. I used to look up to you. Now you're just a handsome Man United player. What's happened to you, Marcus?
So, Dane, we are in, I think, week 13, 14 of lockdown. How has it all been for you?
For the most part, it wasn't that bad. I think the general consensus amongst a lot of other performing artists and creatives was that it was nice to kind of slow down and really just detox, because especially a lot of the time you have to contextualize your professional existence within social media and stuff. And social media is basically like the equivalent of, I mean, it's the equivalent of walking down a busy market in a developing nation whereby everyone's like, come to my store. Yeah, you look like a nice man. You come here. You like breasts. You come here. And so it's just trying to make yourself stand out in that kind of pandemonium. So it was nice to kind of take a break and detox and really take stock of self. So it was cool initially. And even like I said, it was seeing London's aesthetic without it being filled with people in their rampant pursuit of capitalist gain. It was good at first, and then it got boring a bit, and then Dominic Cummins ruined it for everyone. So
with his drive-by eyesight test.
But after that, I was like, well, if he's doing it now, it doesn't really add up. So for the most part, it's been quite good, man. I think I've not dealt with any more adversity than most people. The most difficult part of lockdown, that's for me, has been, and I imagine for most people, has been, like, you know, having some family members or distant family members or friends or family members, or family members' friends, you know, what the actual COVID-19 virus, how it affected people, has been probably the hardest part. You know, thankfully, you know, there's not been too many casualties on my side of the family, although, you know, some people have been sick. But I'm very grateful that it's not affected me directly and so much indirectly as a lot of other people. So once you think about it, that gives you perspective. And so it's been tough, man, but I know that people go through a lot worse. Like, so we don't even talk about Syria anymore. Remember that? The fuck is that shit? What happened there? So, you know, when I think about stuff like that, it's like, however adverse it's been, it's not made me ignorant to, you know, the plights that most people deal with on a endemic basis.
You mentioned social media. Have you found this a time that you have been able to switch off from social media? Because I think it's really sort of pulled me in more so than it ever did.
Yeah. No, it was the same with me as well. I think because of the fact that people weren't able to perform live, then the idea initially was that social and digital media would supplement the need to appear and perform. And even then, I think I approached social media, because it sucked me in, but I tried to approach it in the same way that I approach comedy, in that when certain issues and topics come up, like, rather than going for it like, you know, piranhas after bloody chunks, I kind of like took my time and looked at the lay of the land. And like I do with comedy on a live basis, that I don't really want to say things just for the sake of saying them. I want to have something to say. And that's kind of how I treated that. I definitely had a large emphasis on online content, but I made sure that I curated that and made sure that it appeared in a way that wouldn't damage the brand. And like I said, it's not just a question of jumping up and flashing my boobs like everybody else does on Instagram.
Have you found this a productive time? You talked a little bit about sort of taking a step back, but have you found it productive in sort of your work?
I know, I definitely found it productive. It's going to be time to focus on things that I maybe previously was kind of skimming over. It's been productive in terms of just allowing me to learn the discipline of performing straight down the lens of a camera to an online audience, which the idea was quite off-putting, but, you know, it was a new skill I had to get used to. But then it potentially can be a lot more beneficial, because, you know, YouTube as digital media stream and what it's able to create in terms of revenue and profile for people. Before, like, I think there was a real snobbery about it, being like, they're not real performers if they're using the internet. But, you know, it's just a different skill, and it's taught me to adapt and be able to contextualize my creativity in a different way. I've been exercising a bit more, drinking a bit more water, reading a little bit more. I say a little bit because, like, some stuff I read on the internet, and I think if you read stuff with your thumbs, it shouldn't really count. So I guess I'm just skimming. But it has been productive in terms of, like, getting in shape and taking care of my health, which on the road is something that's very difficult to do in my line of work. So, yeah, I mean, I can't remember the last time I've had, like, chips in a styrofoam box. So that's a good thing.
How have you found doing those kind of digital comedy gigs? Because, of course, I saw you at the COVID Arms, which was hosted by Kerry Pritchard-McLean, who was, of course, a guest on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. And you were brilliant. How did you find doing that? Is it a surreal experience when you're so used to getting that audience reaction?
I think the first time it's kind of surreal. When I was able to perform at the COVID Arms, like, I really eased in. Because that day I'd actually done an earlier gig as well. So I'd already kind of eased in. But yeah, it's a weird one because you don't get to hear everybody's laughs and stuff. But thankfully, you know, Kiri and Jake and Jess and all the guys that organise it are so supportive. So you feel a bit more comfortable because they're almost like laughing at you as you're going through the material. But I kind of treat it in the discipline whereby, like, where I've done shows like Live at the Apollo, where even though there is a live audience, but you're kind of essentially performing for the camera to the audiences at home. So it's kind of applying that same logic. Or if you've done previous acting work whereby you might nail a punchline and be like, ha, and everyone goes, well done. Now, take two. We do a close, then we do another take where we're doing a wide shot. Then we'll do a cheat over the shoulder. So like, you just learn through repetition that it's you can't always, in certain incarnations when you're performing, you can't always get the immediate response from the audience. So you just have to kind of try and provide with that kind of gusto as if you're performing in a mirror, which was fun because they were a good audience though, at least. So that's fine.
Is there anything that you've missed during lockdown? Anything that you've thought, oh, I really, really miss that?
I've missed being able to play football, and also I've missed eating out. That's what I've missed the most.
Yeah.
I've been doing a lot more cooking, which has been cool, and it's been fun. But I also like to not have to do anything after I finish eating. I think that's what I miss the most, is that meeting friends, having food. Because I'm at an age now where, yeah, food is much more important to me than sex is now. So in lockdown, when people are like, oh, we want some nudes, I'm like, nope, just some food, please.
You've got to get that on a t-shirt.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my friends talk more about meals now than sexual conquests. It's like, oh, man, I've had my fingers in the dirtiest burger, that kind of thing now. So I think I've missed haute cuisine the most.
I genuinely feel selfish for saying this, but I genuinely think the thing that I miss at the moment is getting a haircut. I did think at the start about shaving it all off, but I think with my pale complexion, I'm sort of one top man t-shirt away from looking like the kind of idiot that protects statues.
It's tough. I mean, you know, if there's one thing I can, if there's one instance of black privilege I can identify, probably the only one would be being able to shave my head low and not be judged in the same way. Whereas if you're a white guy, like, it's very narrow options available for a certain age. People will either think you're old or they'll think you're very ill. Or very racist, but it's like those three things are not really going to get you people coming around to talk to you at a bar. So, and even if, I mean, one of them, they might talk to you, but it'll be very patronizing in the tone. So,
or a bit scared.
Yeah. Or somewhat fetishistic. So who knows? So it's tough, but I mean, I get it. The ritual of having a haircut and stuff, there's a certain level of tranquility but if it's any consolation to you, Simon, there's women out there who probably missed the wax for a few months now. Men too. There's some dudes walking around with hairy, hairy butt cracks thinking, oh man, I used to be the man a few months ago.
I mean, this sort of leads me on to my next question, but, and I've not asked this on the podcast, not about waxing, but do you think this time in lockdown has changed you as a person at all?
Definitely not. I just become institutionalized. When you get locked down in the joint, it just really just, it shows you who you really are. And yeah, other than losing a bit of weight, I don't think I've changed much. Just that, like, I left enough weight around about my midriff whereby I was like, I think I've actually found new skin here. So it just means, yeah, I've just stepped up my moisturization process by about 3% to cover those extra bits of skin that are now appeared. But yeah, I don't think I've changed much, man. I just tried to, if anything, I just tried to improve myself physically and mentally for being back out and being able to apply that to my work with a lot more gusto, because it's been so long since I have worked, I want to be able to hit the ground running. Yeah. So anyway, I've changed. It's just been about, yeah, just learning the skill of performing when you can't get an immediate audience. So that can always improve your performance ability. And yeah, just trying to increase my endurance and stamina, because hoping to get back traveling around the world again, because I definitely will never take that for granted.
Well, yeah, before lockdown started, you obviously had the chocolate chip tour ready to go, and that will now be taking place next year. Obviously, comedy theatres are closed at the moment and will likely be the last to reopen. What was it like to write a tour and then have to step back and put that on hold?
Normally, I would fret somewhat, but because the theme of my show was about rising racial tensions in Western Europe and America, and about black rage and how we have to address that before it explodes, it's become really relevant. So I feel like once I get back on tour, people will just see the relevance and the significance of the material in the first place, because, you know, I mean, it's been a part of my editorial, my narrative for a long time, is that, you know, trying to introduce predominantly white Britons to a rudimentary understanding of the black British experience. And I think a lot of critics have kind of tried to downplay that in this country for a long time. So that's why I tried to write like an uncensored, unabashed show about like black anger, and, you know, how much that is even further stoked by the denial of racism. And also, I guess the show was also discussing that juxtaposed with more discussions that we're having about body image and mental health. And yeah, I just felt like, you know, this show has now become somewhat prophetic.
Yeah.
Given the kind of state that we're in the West. So I'm kind of looking forward to it because, I mean, I'm probably not going to open with, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so. But I'll be thinking.
I mean, your trailer for the tour, which you posted on Twitter on May 11th, obviously this was weeks before George Floyd, and then this sudden reappraisal of the UK comedy landscape from, well, forever really. And it featured various racist scenes from TV. As someone who has been talking about this subject for years now, how have you found that conversation in recent weeks around TV in particular?
More recently, I found it somewhat vindicating because now people are, I guess I've been sought for discussion a few times by a few mainstream media outlets, which is a good thing on the one hand. You know, I can't take the publicity for granted, but at the same time, I feel like had people listened to me before, then you wouldn't need to be in a position whereby the discussions you have with black creatives are so binary, where it's like, oh, we've got to talk about racism and racial tensions now, so now we've got to find a black person to talk about, which obviously, you know, from a consultative perspective is a good idea to do, because obviously you want to speak to black people about experience. But at the same time, it's like, because you're so reluctant to show these aesthetics outside of this conversation, that's why now you have an entire lot of people being like, racist? I don't know what it means. And some people walk around being like, I haven't even the most basic idea of discussing having racial discourse because it's not been allowed to happen on my TV screens or within the media for so long. Because, yeah, the spectrum of debates that's normally available to black people is sports racism and racism in sports. So now, again, I'm discussing racism, but, yeah, definitely using it to explain the fact that comedy historically has always been a very, very efficient way to start these conversations and be a catalyst to discuss any social issues. Because by you using humour, you kind of lower people's guard and it's an icebreaker and you can have the conversation. But because the industry has kind of been resistant to try and, you know, emulate what they see in America, then, you know, we're at this place now whereby these things are so tense. So it's been vindicating because I'm like, as I said, it's like, well, I told you so.
Yeah.
But now, yeah, it's allowed me to kind of use these new platforms to, yeah, make people aware of the fact that, like, this is not me being accusatory and this is not a witch hunt to criminalize or try to, like, vilify, you know, British white people. It's really to demonstrate the fact that how can you be expected to have an awareness of the diaspora in the UK because they're not shown anywhere. But despite what you may have heard, we are here. We do have a story and we do have these experiences. And if you really want to improve or approach a more harmonious state, then you have to listen and indulge these things. So it's been useful in that respect.
When I was speaking to Kiri on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, she said that she felt a pressure that when her tour does come back, that people will be expecting her hot and funny take on the past few months. Do you feel that same pressure, not only with lockdown and coronavirus, but on the Black Lives Matter movement to be that kind of spokesperson in comedy for this?
I don't feel it, and I say it's because it's always been a part of my narrative and editorial in the first place. And it wasn't just like, you know, I made a concerted effort to just discuss race all the time in my material. But as I said, you know, anyone that would be looking at the landscape and the zeitgeist of British life would know that people have at best a very rudimentary understanding. And normally the aesthetics they see are normally within very confined spaces, such as, like, you know, the sports industry or the entertainment industry with a particularly Amerocentric focus or a very juvenile focus. Mm. So what you've normally seen historically is that there's been this conflation of black culture with youth culture. So it's this idea that we don't really grow out of that kind of adolescence whereby we have these preoccupations with, like, trainers and music and, like, girls. But, you know, there's a lot of politically and economically mobile black people, members of the Asian community as well, who have a valid gender to discuss as well, but they're not the kind of people that would consume, you know, black creativity in this country. Because it's like, I'm in my 30s. I don't really, I'm not going to hang out with 19-year-olds or respond to that. Like, so I think it's not really been a pressure for me because it's always been a part of who I am anyway. Yeah. And I also feel like, as I said, with any kind of social phenomena, unless you have something valid to say that you know is your actual perspective, then you don't really have to offer an opinion anyway. I think at the very least, what you should do with any artist is have that honesty and transparency that if you don't know what you're talking about, don't really talk about it. Like, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm massively au fait with sexual identity issues. Mm. I may give a perspective, but what I do, I think, is that if I do give a perspective and it does prove to be, like, incorrect or inaccurate, I never have the ego whereby I'm not open to hearing from that community and learning and refining my observations accordingly. But I think as any observational comedian, it would be weird for you not to be able to opine on what's happened because your job is to, you know, accurately cover topics.
Yeah.
Accurately cover contemporary topics. So I think it's been a historic issue in the UK, especially whereby we've always had this kind of leaning towards the whimsical and the surreal. And while it might be entertaining to us to a certain extent, it's like, this is why we have consistently fallen behind Americans in like Forbes lists and the like, in terms of our global appeal, despite the fact that there's so much in common between, you know, British and American life, but ours doesn't seem to. And the fact that in terms of imperialism, our influence has been able to spread all over the world, but comedically not so much, because we don't really address issues like race. So people are like, well, where are these people living?
We're now at a point where lockdown is starting to ease in Britain, in much the same way my dad used to ease his car into a car park. In both scenarios, it's a little too fast and there's a high likelihood of fatalities. how are you feeling about the easing of lockdown?
I feel good about it. I guess it's, I just think just from a biological perspective, keeping people caged up for so long never bodes well. And I would like to think that people will ponder the fact that we treat incarceration as a commodity.
Mm.
And a lot of us couldn't bear to be in our homes for 3 months. So imagine there are people, again, in America, 1% of the entire population is incarcerated. Yeah. And people are in prison for stuff like stealing VHS or non-violent crimes. And, you know, some people, literally because of the lack of funding to post their bail, they take a plea and they have to spend time in prison for not committing any crime. So, you know, if anyone who's had the experience of isolation and found it to be quite negative, I would hope would have that outlook and be a lot more opposed to the penal industrial complex. I've been a bit anxious, as I said, as just getting used to like crowds and stuff again. I think I had a little brush with agoraphobia during my tour. Just because, and it's hard to believe, I could be quite a shy person sometimes, especially when you've reached the, you know, adrenaline-fueled heights of everyone listening to you. Then once that's over the show, you're kind of like, oh, yeah, it's me. And so there can be this level, this kind of sense of, yeah, claustrophobia when you're approached by people and stuff and being in the public eye and, you know, the whole vicious cycle of comparison and observation on social media. So I kind of enjoyed that, having a break from that. But I just think, yeah, for the sake of variety, I am looking forward to seeing how the lay of the land now that lockdown is kind of easing. My biggest concern, I'd say, is that a lot of the lockdown precautions, such as like, you know, banning mass gatherings and how soon are those going to be repealed? Because the idea of a government making laws whereby people can't assemble lawfully and protest already sets a very, very worrying precedent. But other than that, looking forward to being back out there, reconnecting with other human beings. We're a social species. And I think like, so as that will be how we all ease back into the normalcy. We'll just be to interact with other human beings and be open to listening again.
Twitter, as it is so often, was interesting this week as there was this rush to mock people who queued for Primark on day one. And then there was this backlash to the people who mocked the people who queued for Primark. Are you rushing to the shops?
No, I'm trying not to. I mean, consumption wise, I already feel like my level of consumption was kind of more than it needed to be. But I mean, if people are running to Primark, then you need to question what kind of lifestyle that they have. In the same way that, like, when people talk about benefit scroungers, it's like, what kind of lifestyle do you think somebody needs to have for them to like scrounge benefits? Like, it's not a lifestyle to envy. And, you know, before comedy was anyway lucrative, I remember I was on Job Seekers Allowance. No one is in a job centre being like, yeah, I'm getting one over on these people. No one's doing it. And even job seek and being looking for a job or being an adult, it's a system that can definitely trap you.
Mm.
And, you know, a lot of people don't realize that people that are involved in that system looking for a job is work unto itself. And why I always encourage people to remember is, you know, in the same way that people bemoan criminality and try to support the police despite the brutality, if there was no crime, they wouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
Just like, if everybody in the job centre got a job, you know who'd be out of work? The people that work at the job centre. So, you know, you have to understand that there are people that have some commercial interest in maintaining these things. So, yeah, I just think, but I also think that, like, you should always, getting involved in online discourse is the same way as just if you're on a school bus with a coach load of kids, just trying to get them to all to have a structured conversation. It's not going to happen. So I just don't really take it too seriously. But I just think myself personally, yeah, I think it's definitely something we should learn because I think one of the big benefits of the lockdown globally was that it allowed for some wildlife and for the environment to flourish. Like, you know, like the canals in Venice were becoming clearer, saw a rise in the population of bees. And so I've been aware that like the amount of water and vegetation that is kind of damaged for the textile industry is significant. Like, you know, apparently 6 gallons, like six, I think that's not 6 gallons, but maybe more than that, just to make a pair of jeans.
Yeah. No, I think I read that as well.
Like loads of like gallons and gallons of water in order to make jeans, and like use of cotton. It's like it's causing soil erosion and stuff. So I was like, if I can help to not contribute to that, then I should probably leave it. So for that reason, and I hopefully I can continue. I'm just like, yeah. And I got a shitload of t-shirts, man, and people give me stuff. Like, there's no need to be, I don't need to be buying any more stuff.
The other thing that everyone also now wants to do as lockdown is easing is to meet in parks. I don't think I've met a friend in a park since the age of 11. And even then, I think they just wanted to search for porn in bushes.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a large deal. Like, not a lot of savory stuff happens in parks, right? You know, not in public parks. In the same way that when people used to be like, you can't have gender neutral toilets. Anybody can walk in there. Like, no one wants to spend a lot of time in a public toilet. You know, it's not the best environment. So, yeah, the park thing is very strange. But then again, I think, you know, there was a time when being close to nature, spending time with the family prior to, like, you know, change the explosion of media, that was probably a nice little pastime before it was ruined by television and paedophiles. Paedophiles ruin parks for everybody. And paedophiles and negligent dog owners.
Oh, yeah. Like, I see a lot of dog owners and they don't clear up after their dogs at the moment.
This might be the most conservative thing I've ever said, Simon, this week. But I think if you can use DNA targeting, or you can track people with, like, tags. You know, dogs get tags and they can track them electronically. You can track a car electronically.
Yeah.
I think they should get all legal dogs on a database with their DNA, and if you leave your dog shit somewhere, we check that shit. If that's your dog shit, you get a fine. Dog owners have got shitloads of disposable income because the pet food industry is more lucrative than feeding children in this country, as we know. Therefore, I think, because a lot of people are leaving their shit everywhere, I'm saying, if I get a ticket for leaving my car somewhere it's not supposed to be, you should get a ticket for leaving your dog shit where it shouldn't be. And we should be able to test that. And you should get a fine, a massive fine. It's a revenue stream for the government, makes for a nicer, cleaner environment. And if you really, and like, you know, money from those fines could probably make us, like, you know, finance some compost bins. Mm. Then we can start putting that dog shit in those compost bins, in biodegradable bags. Then we start building up all this compost. And then you've got a natural source of compost for more vegetation to grow.
I mean, that's the best idea we've had on the podcast so far, I think.
I mean, I've had a lot of time to think about this stuff, Simon. I'm at work. I'm broke. Okay.
I want to talk a little bit about TV, as we've been watching so much of it in lockdown. But first, we do have to talk about the fact that your brilliant scripted sitcom from 2016, Sunny D, has returned to BBC iPlayer after an online campaign. That's amazing. I loved it when it was first on. I loved all the funny cutaways and the asides. It had such a great cast, including the legendary Don Warrington.
Absolutely.
For anyone who hasn't seen it, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so basically Sunny D is kind of a quasi autobiographical story of my life before I started doing comedy. And yeah, it's just a funny comedy vehicle that I put together, which reflects all of my influences. Like, you know, I grew up watching a lot of sitcoms from the States on Trouble, used to be in the UK, as well as, you know, I was a really massive fan of adult animation in comedy.
Yeah.
Simpsons being obviously the longest running sitcom of all time. But like some of my favorites, like South Park, The Boondocks, you know, animated films like The Baby's Kids and Crapston Villas, which is stop motion animation we had here, Spit an Image. Like, I always felt like, you know, using animation and a certain element of surrealism allowed you to embellish stories for comedic effect in ways you couldn't actually do with live action. Mm. But then, you know, as kind of time went on and this opportunity came up, I wanted to reflect all of that in a show where, as I said, because, you know, I was aware that Sunny D is the first sitcom with a black majority cast on British TV in 20 years.
Wow.
Again, I was aware that, you know, you essentially have an entire generation of people who have not really had exposure to this kind of aesthetic.
Yeah.
So I wanted to create something which was obviously very mindful of my culture, but wasn't the sole voice for it. But, you know, it was relatable. And like I said, create something which was not a black sitcom, but it's just a sitcom which incidentally has black people in it. And, you know, it's a great experience. And I was the first time writer on the show. and I wanted to get, you know, some undiscovered talent and some diamonds in the rough to appear on the show as well. So, you know, cue David Ajayo and Bemi Ikemelo, who both were in the Royal Shakespeare Company. And, you know, you fast forward 4 years and David is now a regular actor on the BBC and an award nominee.
Yeah.
And Bemi also last month was nominated for a BAFTA. So for me, the fact that their television experience began with Sunny D is so humbling. Even Akemji Dufournian, who played my cousin on the show as well, he's actually gone on now to write and star and produce his own sketch show, which is Famalam.
Yeah, so of course.
All these things covered, having their origins from Sunny D as well, has been amazing. And as I said, to have Don Warrington to show the full circle of being one of the first ever black actors on a sitcom, to, you know, to appear as a patriarch of mine was just so humbling and just you know, testament to what can happen if stars align in your favor. But yeah, it was a fun show. It's a short experience, but yeah, I just think you know, like I said, it was a whole generation, you know, that kind of lost out on something that represented them. So I wanted Sunny D to reflect that with like the kind of 90s-esque soundtrack, 90s, early noughties soundtrack, and a lot of the aesthetics and kind of the references, nostalgic references and stuff as well. But yeah, it was definitely me, as I said, you know, growing up with shows like The Cosby Show and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And these are shows that were shown in the UK. And I just felt like, you know, Britain and on a larger scale, Europe, we should have the same thing. And that's what I tried to create with the show myself. So it was a wonderful experience, but it was definitely bolstered by all of the people around me that helped, allowed it to happen.
I don't want to spoil how the series ends. It does end with a lot of possibilities for future series. Did you have an idea where you wanted it to go?
Yeah, I definitely wanted it to continue, man. Like how I kind of saw Sunny D was that, as I said, because we were aware of the fact that, you know, it's trying to provide a nostalgia for, you know, 20 years of lost time and arts and contribution to British popular culture. And moving forward, I would have hoped the show would have done that. And kind of, I made the show as a massive sitcom fan and someone who is aware of the knowledge of other sitcom fans as well. So, you know, it was someone who was trying to make a sitcom as a fan of sitcoms and make a show that didn't underestimate the intelligence of its viewers. And I just left it open because I just didn't want to be constrained by, you know, typical paradigms of like how you, of those formats whereby they might be 25 to a half an hour long and appear at the same time and always having the same enter and exit stage left. So yeah, I just wanted to create something very different. And even though not a lot of people are aware of Sunny D, you can kind of look at how that appeared, you know, as long ago as 2016. And then fast forward now where you have shows like Atlanta and Enterprise. Yeah. Now so many shows that no longer follow the kind of classic structure of a sitcom. But I think, yeah, we would definitely had the curve with it. So I left it open to hopefully to return to it. And, you know, I definitely wanted to leave the open-ended, which means we could take it in so many different directions. And, you know, the ideal thing would be with me to carry on with the story, maybe in a different guise or under a different name, but definitely using the same aesthetics, the same kind of styling. And if I'm lucky enough to be able to use talent, the same talent or equivalent talent as well. And, yeah, how I saw it was that by the end of it, it would have been like a very lovely way of kind of celebrating both black British culture and British culture and the phenomenon of the kind of like the sitcom as well. Yeah. And really, really make something that allowed everyone of my peers, whether they're in the creative industry or not, to see, because, you know, it's the same as my journey that like I felt like I was arriving at what I refer to as a quarter life crisis and a very existential one, which I felt was shared by a lot of people like myself who, you know, went to university at a time during like, you know, the Blairite years. And now graduating, it was kind of like, well, I can't even afford a fucking house in London. What? I won't even get a pension at the end of my working life. So there's a lot of angst and anger. And I think a disillusionment that a lot of our peers kind of shared. And I just wanted it to kind of capture it. So, I mean, hopefully I'll get the opportunity to do that again. But yeah, it's definitely wanted it to be part of one voice among many for a generation.
I hadn't appreciated at the time that it was the first black British sitcom on TV in 20 years. When you look at, I guess, the black shows that have followed, things like Chewing Gum, as you say, Famalam, which has its DNA really stitched into Sunny D, things like The Latest Show with Mo Gilligan, Big Nasty Show.
Yeah.
Do you look at that as a positive list, or do you think that list is still not long enough?
It's both. It's positive because it's progress compared to where we were maybe a few years ago. But yeah, definitely for me, more work definitely needs to be done. The list needs to be definitely a lot more extensive. And we also, I'd say, the diversity, as I said, the fact is, it's just they're moving away from that conflation of black culture with youth culture. Because, you know, if you look at, like, you know, white British institutions like AbFab or Last of the Summer Wine, Darling Buds of May, the archetypes and the characters depicted in these shows are very obviously over 30 and live a life which is very relatable to a certain demographic. And even now, still, there are no black equivalents whereby you're seeing black people in their 30s and their 40s living and thriving at an age whereby you consider stuff like, you know, schooling for your kids and your life after retirement and stuff. And again, I think once those exist, it's going to be so much more relatable to what's arguably the largest demographic in the UK, which is like your over 35s towards your 60s and stuff. So I think that's what we're needing most as well, is that it's having these black equivalents that exist to represent even the subgenres of, you know, the Black British caucus, whether it's like, you know, LGBT shows or black trans shows or, like, you know, I said, black shows for, like, you know, black geriatrics or for young black people, for black intellectuals, you know, black working class, black middle class, and, you know, black satire, and just every single other facet you see within, which comes under the banner of British comedy, is having that represented by black people in the incidental fashion whereby it's not on a separate reservation where we're like, well, this is the black thing we're doing as well, because then that's always going to still have that division. I think once we get to a point whereby you see a show and like the latest show is not referred to as like a black show, or even some of these aren't referred to as a black sitcom, then we'll be in a good place.
In light of recent events around the world, do you feel positive that we'll see action to change that moving forwards?
I'm quite positive. I'm cautiously optimistic about it. I think the most positive thing is seeing that there is an entire generation, younger generation, who are a lot more politically astute and are more historically aware than we've been given them credit for, especially because of how they're depicted in the media. But, you know, for all of the ways we've been bemoaning younger generations about all of their privilege and their lack of awareness, they have definitely stepped up to assert their humanity and their freedom. So I would find it very hard to believe there wouldn't be any kind of change. And I just think, like I said, the transparency that's come with social media and with, you know, the democratization of voices on digital media means we're probably at a stage now where this can no longer be ignored. I don't really think we can go back to a state as we've been anymore. So, and I just think for our generation and for preceding ones, you know, following our wars, we've had like a relative peace in the West compared to how the rest of the world have lived. But it's always very naive and somewhat stupid to think that you can observe all of these injustices in the world and at some point they won't be at your doorstep because wildfire spread. So, and that's even in LA. You know, LA is supposed to be Hollywood where dreams come true, but, you know, once a fire starts, it still reaches those homes as well. So, you know, once a fire is burning, and in this case, you know, being revolution, at the very least, you're still going to have to inhale the smoke.
A lot of people will be listening today and thinking how they can be an ally to the Black Lives Matter movement to keep that momentum that has hopefully grown over these past few weeks going. And that's not just about putting a black square on your Instagram. It's about supporting meaningful change. As you say, it's about changing the makeup of rooms of decision makers. Beyond education and going out there and finding out about the issues, what else should we be doing?
I think what I would say people to do is that, I mean, initially the same approach you take is the same approach that we observe with the whole Me Too thing, in that it's like, you know, you have to believe women. You have to believe these stories from black people about police brutality and these injustices. You have to believe them. I think any person that's capable of thinking critically should know, like, even speaking from the perspective of comedy and even socially in the UK, people are relatively secular and no one follows the letter of the Bible because we are all aware that, you know, religion as an institution is very corrupt. In the same way that we are known globally as some of the best satirists in the world because English people are staunchly aware that their government is also corrupt. Now, these are the two institutions that feed into the police because the police enforce policies on behalf of both of these two institutions. So if you have these two corrupt institutions in government and in the church and they both serve the, and they both feed into the police, then obviously the police must be corrupt. In the same way that if you have two adults who are both addicted to or abusing a substance, if they have a child, their child is probably going to be a crack baby. So, you know, the police essentially are the crack baby of the church and the state and, you know, enforcing policies. And I think, you know, for perspective, so if you're, for example, somebody who definitely has a lot of friends in the entertainment industry who may be of the LGBT community, just remember 40 years ago, if your friends were holding hands in the street, the police would beat them up and put them in prison and it'd be legal for them to do so. So, you know, I think people should suspend all of their classic ideas about civility and legality and look at the morality of what's happening. And I think, yeah, just in the same way that I think the approach is to do the same way when you're dealing with misogyny and sexism, is that rather than trying to reassure the affected groups that you are an ally, you should prove your allyship when they're not around. And in your own words, when you hear people flippantly using racist language or racially divisive language or engaged in any discriminatory practice, pull them up on it, even if there's no black people for you to see there. In the same way that, you know, you feed the homeless, but you don't do it for the gram, you do it because it's what's supposed to be done. So, you know, it's not about me saying to women, oh, I recognize you're a human being and you're an equal human being to me. It's more about the fact that if my male friends say something, you know, flippantly sexist, it's pulling them up on that and being like, whether or not you think you're joking, this feeds into a system in which women are massively oppressed. And so you have to not do that anymore. And I think that's what people could do as allies. And, you know, you see a lot of people, you know, having to challenge some of the more reluctantly having to challenge racism within their own families and stuff. But it's very admirable. And I say it does seem like it's difficult. But what I would submit to your predominantly white listeners is that, like, just think about it. You know, you look at somewhere like the UK or America, we sell the most makeup, we sell the most cosmetic surgery. You know, people in the States and people in the UK, or even like Brazil, which has one of the largest African populations outside of the continent, are people that use the most cosmetic surgery, require the most antidepressants, require the most psychiatric help. If the way of life they were living was working, they wouldn't need to do that. So if that's any consolation to you, is that, like, obviously this is not working, you know, because at the same time, you know, if you're going to consider people subhuman and then you're going to rape and abuse them, then you're still raping and abusing animals. So it's like, all I'd say to other people is that, like, as scary as it is, continuing a world like this will be much scarier, because if people believe, or if there are powers that believe they can oppress a group of people, they never stop there. You know, corruption never gets to a plateau where, like, I think we've taken a piss enough. So, you know, to quote the Manic Street Preachers, if you tolerate this, your children will be next. And that's why Marcus Rashford has to do what he does.
Dane, lockdown has been all about television, at least for me. Mm-hmm. If it had been about ab crunches instead of crunchies, then I would have been laughing in this period. What have you been watching on TV?
I have been watching, I guess I'll try to get the highlights. So The Last Dance was a documentary on the Chicago Bulls, the highly decorated Chicago Bulls. That was really good. So I enjoyed watching that. I've been watching New Girl, been binging New Girl with Zooey Deschanel.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's great. And now that I've seen it, I understand why so many young middle-class white women on open mic would come on stage and talk about, like, doing crafts and playing ukuleles, because now I've met their queen. So I get it now. But it's good, though. It's a really good sitcom, man. Elizabeth Merriweather definitely needs to take a bow, because it's a really good sitcom. Very well written. And then what else have I been watching? I'm into, like, a lot of anime and stuff as well. So I've been watching and reading a lot more anime. I've just finished watching Preacher from AMC, and I'm starting to watch The Boys. I'm getting into a lot of the more hardcore, a lot more of the adult graphic novels that have been adapted for TV, because some of the more children-oriented or, like, mainstream-oriented stuff, like, I don't need to see Gotham. Like, I don't care what Alfred did. I don't fuck. And they were like, coming soon, Alfred. Alfred! It's like Penny first. I don't care about Alfred. So I've not been paying attention. So I've been watching those. And then I think because of my attention span sometimes, I like to, the digital world allows me to, like, flip between. I spend a lot of time in YouTube rabbit holes, basically. Yeah. I've been enjoying a lot of Joe Rogan by doing that. And so I enjoy watching the clips of his podcast. But I think the coolest thing I saw most recently was Dave Chappelle's very short 8:43.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, that was really good. So that was probably the last thing I watched that really got to me. Yes, I admired it. And the admiring is artistry, because as a comedian, I personally believe that, you know, the goal of all observational comedians is we make observations on a surface level initially. But if you're really going to appeal to an audience, it's being able to observe the things that your mind's eye can see. And I really feel like Dave Chappelle has transcended to that point whereby he's approaching the status of philosopher rather than just comedian. Mm. And it's an amazing thing to see. And something to aspire to.
A lot of people during this time have also been listening to podcasts, thankfully. And I love your podcast, Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, which has, of course, been going since 2018. I was listening to the Emil Heskey episode last night. Obviously, as a Liverpool fan, I appreciate that he was very, very underappreciated.
Yes, massively.
Can you tell us a little bit about your podcast for anyone who hasn't listened in yet?
Absolutely, yeah. Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. Yeah, just continues the theme of my world outlook, whereby I feel like by asking questions, we are able, that's the beginning catalyst to changing our reality. So I just try to encourage that on a podcast whereby, you know, we are a lot of the time very socially obligated, or it's encouraged for us. It's encouraged, especially within the UK, that we don't question a lot of things, and we've grown up in systems of like feudalism and monarchism and like classism. So a lot of time we create states where, for example, if you're a working class person, you go to a pub, you're not supposed to discuss religion or politics, even though these two things govern the mechanics of your existence. So it would make sense if you're a member of the proletariat, for lack of a better term, to talk about like these things, because these things govern how you're supposed to live.
Yeah.
You know, because the church will tell you, if you're a working class person of an LGBT extraction, that how you live is incorrect. So then now your life is affected by these policies, even though you caused no harm or loss to any other human being. Political policy would again determine how you live. Like, now you got to pay a bedroom tax. So I think maybe working class people should discuss their reality a lot more. So yeah, the whole theme of my podcast is basically just to provide a platform so that people can muse and ask and think about any passing stupid things. So the podcast is for any time people have fleeting thoughts or ideas, no matter how trivial, no matter how surreal. Like, you know, like when people say stuff like, how can they make seedless grapes? Or how come you never see any baby pigeons? You know, that kind of thing. What is burger sauce really made from? Like anything, any question that people normally find is like shouted down at a dinner table, or, you know, by a partner, or people that don't explain it. Or even, you know, I think a lot of people in school probably had questions, certain elements of their reality and their existence. And the response would have been, you have to put your hand up before you speak. And I always think that's always an issue whereby we are being taught to concede to authority and not question it. And so, yeah, my the idea of the sitcom of this podcast is to kind of encourage more questioning from everybody.
And over the 2 years, you've asked so many questions and answered many of them. What questions have you been thinking about that you would like to cover soon?
And the main things at this stage now are, when are we going to start getting a dividend from the banks we've bailed out? Now the banks have been bailed out with another stimulus package. So if they start reporting bonuses, how soon can we set up a framework so us as the people that bailed them out can start seeing a dividend? Then how is Brexit going to, why did you need to do Brexit anyway? Because now we're on the lockdown, probably would have been fine. So how is that going to proceed? And then my only question is that, like, you know, we are in a recession. Can we start looking at, like, you know, schemes like expenses from the MPs to find out, to scrutinize where our money goes? And finally, my most pointing questions now are what's happening with Grenfell? And then my main question, I guess, always is, where is the love?
Dane.
Where is the love?
Dane, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really enjoyed that.
No problem. Thank you very much. This has left enough time for my green tea to get to a drinkable temperature. So it's been perfect. Winners all round.
Where is the love? What a point to end on. A little bit of intel about how we record these episodes. So for the large part, it's a free-flowing conversation. But we did have a brief pause after the portion on Black Lives Matter because I was listening so intently to what Dane was saying, I couldn't remember what we were doing next. I also had a lot of technical issues prior to this episode, including rain literally pouring through my ceiling. So thank you, Dane, for being a very patient as well as brilliant guest. Do check out Dane's podcast, Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, and his brilliant sitcom, Sunny D, is now on BBC iPlayer. That is it for another episode. Last week's show with Jason Watkins had a huge reaction, especially the portion on bereavement. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, please, please, please do read the show notes first. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please make your homework this week to tell one friend about this podcast. And if you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be back very, very soon. But in the meantime, and as much as you can, please stay indoors.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.